Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the story of the U.S. Marines surrounded and outnumbered something like 10 to 1, fighting one of the most legendary battles of the Korean War. We'll spend this hour with historian Hampton Sides talking about why General Douglas MacArthur ordered 13,000 Americans to take up positions along the banks of the Chosin Reservoir, despite mounting evidence that the communist Chinese army would show up to fight even without comparable weapons. MacArthur promised a quick and easy campaign. His men endured 17 days of battle in temperatures that hovered around 20 degrees below zero. We'll hear some remarkable stories about how those men hung on and about how survivors managed to escape when the call was finally made for them to retreat. Our conversation starts after a short break. When General Douglas MacArthur, from his offices safe in Tokyo, ordered the 1st Marine Division to seize the Chosin Reservoir in November of 1950, he said those 13,000 Americans and UN allies would forever liberate South Korea from the threat of North Korean invasions and probably be home in time to celebrate Christmas. Instead, they spent 17 days fighting in weather so cold that bullet wounds iced themselves over and frozen corpses were stacked into makeshift defensive barriers. U.S. troops had been quickly surrounded by Chinese fighters defending North Korea, and the Chinese sent something like 10 men for every American at Chosin. MacArthur had ample intelligence to suggest the Chinese would show up ready to fight, and he ignored it. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. As historian Hampton Sides will tell us, Chosin gives us both an example of the worst kind of military hubris and the bravest and wisest sort of on-the-ground leadership by Marine Major General Oliver P. Smith, who kept up the fight as long as he could and then led a brilliant and successful tactical retreat. Hampton Sides tells the story in his new book, On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, the Korean War's Greatest Battle. Hampton, welcome back to Think.
It's good to be back with you.
So how did it happen that at the end of the Second World War, Korea was divided? And what did the 38th parallel sort of represent to the rest of the world?
Well, after World War II, the Allied powers were given this task of trying to sort of divvy up the spoils of the Japanese empire. And of course, Korea had been a colony of Japan for decades. And however, Stalin and the Soviet Union had kind of come to the Pacific theater of the war kind of late in the game, and they wanted some of these spoils as well. So what was originally intended to be a temporary arrangement was cooked up where essentially, Stalin would get the northern half of Korea, and we would get the southern half of Korea, and sort of be the custodian nations, just like we did with say Berlin. And but this was meant to be temporary because the idea was this is one people, this is one language, this is one culture. Korea is one place. It was never meant to be, and should never have been divided. So they looked around for where would the dividing line be? And conveniently, there just so happens to be this 38th parallel, which more or less divides the country in half. And it was a young diplomat, Dean Rusk, that is believed to have been the guy who proposed it, seemed convenient enough, and that was the line. And of course, this idea that we would all get together and have an election and let Korea be Korea never happened. These two halves of Korea began to take on the characteristics of their custodian nations. Stalin, trained an army and sent his advisors in, and Kim Il Sung, who's the grandfather of the current leader, studied under Stalin. The sort of the cult of personality begins to take hold. All these enormous billboards to the great leader, and it becomes really a puppet state of Stalin. And so that's the sort of the backdrop leading up to the beginning of the Korean War.
It made me think about, and I don't mean to minimize this, but there was that experiment with schoolboys in Oklahoma back in the 40s or 50s, and they took a bunch of kids and they said, okay, you guys are one side and you guys are another side. And overnight, these boys that had been friends really despised one another. There's that kind of group mentality that takes over.
Yes. Well, there was also deeply embedded in Korean culture coming out of World War II a culture of recrimination, basically. If you had collaborated with the Japanese, or if you had not. And there was a lot of reprisal killings and kind of guerrilla border skirmishes. There was a lot actually simmering beneath the surface. It was almost like a low-grade civil war that was happening in 1947, 1948, 1949, as we lead up to the Korean War. So there was something there, but basically there's no appreciable difference between North and South Korea, you know, in terms of, yeah, there's some minor dialect differences, but essentially it's the same country, and it's a great tragedy that it was ever divided in the first place.
How strategically important was South Korea to Truman and the United States?
Well, it was important in large part because of the huge investment that we were putting into the rebuilding of Japan. Of course, MacArthur was leading the occupation of Japan and was the de facto emperor by that point. And Korea had always been this sort of jumping off point for invading armies interested in Japan. It's, you know, it's just across the strait there. And unfortunately, throughout history, Korea has been this sort of, you know, sort of in the way kind of country. The Russians, the Manchus, the Mongols, you know, and then the Japanese. Everyone had sort of come up and down that peninsula and used it as a kind of jumping off point for various invasions. It was also strategically important in the sense that we were obviously rebuilding Japan, but we wanted to create a sphere of influence in that part of Asia that would be pro-capitalistic, pro-democracy. You know, we wanted to kind of reform this part of the world in our own image. Meanwhile, Mao in China was involved in this civil war, this long civil war against Chiang Kai-shek and his nationalist forces. And so Korea begins to assume much more strategic importance than you would think just by looking at this map and saying, what's the story with this mountainous scrap of land that juts off the mainland? Why is it so important? Why are we going to devote so much of our national treasure and resources to defending this place?
I feel like if you were writing a novel and you drew up the character of Douglas MacArthur, your editor would say, Hampton, seriously, tone this down.
It's too much.
It's too much. So tell us about him.
Well, MacArthur, you know, was probably our most arrogant, most vainglorious commander that we've ever had. I don't know at this point, 1950, if we've ever had a commander in whom we had concentrated so much power. He was not only running the occupation of Japan, but he was in charge of all the UN forces. He was in charge of the Army of the Far East. His stock had never been higher. He was brilliant. He was brilliant, but usually the first to admit it. They said he was in love with the vertical pronoun. It was all about him. Theatrical, very sort of microscopically attuned to media.
Even his wardrobe was a big deal for him.
His wardrobe, his pipe, the way he carried himself when he marched into the room. He was always conscious of the cameras. He was, some people say, a brilliant strategist. I suppose he certainly had his victories in World War II and in Korea. But he just as often made just massive mistakes. You know, everything he did was spectacular, whether it was a success or a failure. But he also had a constitutional inability to admit error or blame, assume blame, or to apologize for mistakes. You know, from a writer's point of view, he is a gift that keeps on giving. You know, he's like a narrative. Everything he says is quotable. Mm-hmm. He's got huge insecurities and vulnerabilities, like so many narcissistic people do. And in this one little chapter of his life, you see his greatest high, which is his victory at Incheon, which was this enormous amphibious invasion of the port that serves Seoul. And then you see his really greatest defeat, which is when the Chinese enter the war and just ravage his forces all across North Korea, which ultimately, you know, leads to a series of events which leads to his being fired by Truman. So you see his highs and you see his lows all in this one episode of his life.
So the landing at Incheon shouldn't have worked, but it did.
It did work. It was brilliantly successful. The reason why it was so risky And the reason why his superiors back in Washington didn't want to land there was that there is an enormous tidal fluctuation there. And if you don't time it just exactly right, you end up with all these vessels being stranded on these mud flats, and you'd be sitting duck out there. And, you know, it had to be just right. And luckily, they did time it right. The 1st Marine Division, which was kind of the spearhead of the invasion, came ashore and surprised the North Koreans. And they weren't able to put up much of a fight. And consequently, they took Incheon very quickly, took Seoul, and MacArthur's stock had never been higher. You know, he was the sorcerer, someone said, the sorcerer of Incheon. He could do no wrong. He, you know, he was a wizard. But that success is actually is the beginning of his failure, because he begins to believe his own press, and he begins to get greedy. He's not going to just push to the 38th parallel. He's going to keep pushing beyond the 38th parallel. Why not take Pyongyang? Why not take the mountains of North Korea? Why not take it all the way to the Yalu River, which is the border with Manchuria, which is precisely what he tries to do.
It's worth noting that the recapture of Seoul for South Korea was not a surgical strike. That city was really heavily damaged.
Heavily damaged, and you know, there was a lot of door-to-door fighting. There was a bombardment that happened partly because MacArthur had this weird idea. This is one of his many ideas. He thought he was an expert on what he called the Asiatic mind. And he said Asians are acutely aware of numerology. And the war had begun in June 25th of 1950. And he wanted to take Seoul exactly 3 months to the day of that initial invasion, whether it was ready or not. And the real way to do that was just to bombard the city and just devastate it and shake it to its very foundations with heavy artillery, which is what they did. I mean, Seoul was just leveled in this retaking. So it was probably a lot more brutal than it needed to be, but it was all to meet this deadline, this sort of artificial, contrived deadline that MacArthur had come up with to meet this numerology idea that he had. He was always tossing out grand and grandiose ideas like this and expecting his officers to follow him.
So Harry Truman was a smart guy. Did he have reservations about all the power that he had given to Douglas MacArthur?
I think everyone back in Washington had doubts about all this power that MacArthur had. I mean, you know, he was like the emperor over there. And Truman was very leery of him. And of course, there's politics involved here, mm-hmm. too, because everyone thought that MacArthur might run for president. But they, you know, it's very unpatriotic to sort of criticize the man in charge over there and criticize the army. And midterm elections were coming up in November. So it was a very delicate political environment back home in Washington. Truman's main concern was that this might escalate, this regional conflict in Korea might escalate truly into a world war. We'd just been through a world war. We're still recovering from that war. We were just beginning finally to experience this economic boom in the GI Bill and, you know, like good times in America. And then here is this regional conflict, which has all these, it's, you know, fissures and it's sort of striking, you know, all kinds of points that could just explode at any minute if the cards aren't played right. He was worried the Soviets would get actively involved in it, and he was especially concerned that the Chinese would get actively involved in this war, and then you would essentially have a world war. And however, Truman said, MacArthur said, don't worry about it. You know, the Chinese are not going to get involved. And even if they do, it's going to be a bloodbath. We will destroy them and we will get our troops to the Yalu River by Christmas.
All right. We'll talk about how that played out in just a minute. My guest is Hampton Sides. He's a historian and editor at large for Outside Magazine. His new book is called On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, The Korean War's Greatest Battle. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is historian Hampton Sides, whose new book is On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, the Korean War's Greatest Battle. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. All right, let's talk about MacArthur's decision to try and seize this reservoir at Chosin. Where is this located, and what made MacArthur think that would be a good strategic target?
Well, MacArthur was mainly interested in just going all the way to the Yalu, and this reservoir is kind of in the way. But it was an asset that was strategically important to the Chinese because it produced a lot of hydroelectric power that fed into these grids that reached all the way into Manchuria, into Chinese territory. And the Chinese had made it very clear this was an asset that they were going to defend. But MacArthur, you know, just dismissed all this. He pushed his men up through this mountainous terrain. Unfortunately, there was only one road that led into this country. It was this kind of twisty, single-lane dirt road that, you know, as you went up into the mountains, it became this classic ambush country. It's the kind of place where you just worried that if you got surrounded, a long, thin column, a convoy of troops would be very vulnerable. And as they moved towards this lake, now the lake by this point was frozen solid. It was a sheet of ice. Winter had come with a vengeance by late November of 1950, and it was 25 below zero. And, you know, back in the old days when armies encountered this kind of weather, they would say,
we'll see you in the spring.
Yeah, you'll see in the spring, lay down your arms, gentlemen's agreement, we'll pick this back up. But here, you know, in this case, they were marching towards this kind of tragic collision up at this reservoir. And this is the setting for the battle.
All right. So Oliver P. Smith is the Marine Major General that MacArthur has put in charge of this campaign. Smith didn't think it was a good idea, but he didn't have a choice.
Yeah. Well, he's a field general. He's not, you know, supposed to understand the grand strategy. Much of the early part of the book is really about the personality clash between General Smith and General MacArthur and another general named General Ned Almond. Smith is a very different kind of person. He's very methodical. He's very cautious. They called him the professor. He's not your typical super macho, gung-ho Marine. He was fluent in French. He studied the classics. He smoked a pipe. He cultivated roses in his spare time. He was an expert gardener. But he began to see this battle, you know, as almost like in slow motion. Weeks before it actually happened, he began to see the trap that Mao and his generals were setting for them. First of all, the Marines began to capture and interrogate Chinese soldiers. And the Chinese soldiers were very forthcoming. They said exactly who they were, where they were from, that there was hundreds of thousands of other Chinese just behind them. We're here. We've been here for weeks. It was kind of strange. So when General Smith sent this intelligence up the food chain to Tokyo, it was very strange because the intelligence officers in Tokyo didn't want to believe it. They said, these can't be real Chinese. They must be volunteers, rogue elements, people just picked up a weapon and, you know, come down of their own free will. This isn't really Mao's army. There's just no way. And, you know, MacArthur by this point had created a universe in Tokyo that was like a hermetically sealed place. He only surrounded himself with yes men, people who told him what he wanted to hear. And so what you have is a recipe for a huge intelligence failure, which is what happened. And then it became a leadership failure because finally the intelligence did come in loud and clear. There's huge numbers of Chinese, and he just didn't want to believe it. It was almost to the point of being delusional. So, yeah, that's the environment that we see as General Smith presses up around this reservoir. He begins to fear that there's going to be a great battle, and he begins to take some precautions for that battle, which are kind of strange. One of them being that he decides to build an enormous airfield in the middle of the mountains, in the middle of nowhere, in this wilderness, because he thinks that we're going to need to bring in huge numbers of transport planes and bring out huge numbers of casualties. General Almond said, what casualties? There's not going to be any casualties.
I read that and I couldn't believe it. Like, Almond literally hadn't considered the possibility that many Americans would be wounded.
Mm-hmm. And in the end, this airstrip was built just in the nick of time. And that's a story unto itself, how the engineers kind of clawed this thing from the frozen earth while fighting a battle. They're driving a bulldozer and they're fighting with guns from the backs of their bulldozers. But they do bring in these big transport planes, and ultimately they take out 4,000 casualties. And believe me, these men that were evacuated feel like they owe their life to General Smith and consequently revere him for this decision that he made.
So the Chinese didn't have, not all of them had modern weapons. They didn't really have an air force, but they were fierce fighters, and they outnumbered the Americans like 10 to 1.
They did. They had numerical superiority, and they also were seasoned fighters. They'd been fighting in the Civil War. Many of them, they were guerrillas. They knew how to move at night. They were masters of camouflage. The first part of this sort of intelligence failure, in fairness, you have to say they were difficult to spot from the air because they only moved at night. They never used the roads. They moved over the wilderness, and they hid during the day in mine shafts and in caves, and they lived off the land, and they didn't build any fires that could be spotted from the air. So, you know, in fairness, they were hard to detect at first, but they had great flexibility of movement, and they could use the element of surprise, and they had, as you said, at the top of that, numerical superiority, 10 to 1 in many places of the battlefield.
So the fact that they moved and fought at night was a good reason that we couldn't take them out with airstrikes. Is that right?
Right. They understandably feared and dreaded American superiority. They did not have an air force. The American close air support Corsairs were deadly. They had napalm. They would strafe. They would bomb them. So that's why the attacks always came around midnight, which made the Battle of Chosin Reservoir that much more, you know, haunting and really kind of bizarre. It was always fought in the dead of night with all these flares and, you know, strange eerie light. Sometimes fought just under the moonlight, and the Chinese would. Suddenly, there would be this sort of cacophony of trumpets and shepherd's horns and cymbals and drums, and they would come wave after wave after wave.
Because they didn't have radios, right?
They didn't have radios, and this was the way that they communicated with each other. But they, you know, it scared the bejesus out of the Marines the first or second or third time they heard this, but eventually they began to like this horrible sound because it gave them a little bit of time to prepare for the next wave. The next wave of Chinese soldiers coming at them.
So you've talked to Marines who survived this battle, and you say they're more apt to talk about the weather than the Chinese.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are really three combatants in this battle, the Chinese, the Americans, and the old man Winter. And, you know, it was just a constant force that was physical, but it was also emotional and psychological. A lot of these guys just broke down. Vehicles broke down. Weapons wouldn't fire. You know, the medics, the Navy corpsmen who had to attend to the victims, you know, the morphine would freeze. The plasma would turn to slush. You know, you just can't fight in 20, 30, 35 below zero weather in the same way. The vehicles, they would just leave them on all night for fear that if they turned them off, they would freeze up. The weather actually only had one benefit, and you alluded to it at the top of the hour, which was that wounds would effectively cauterize. They would freeze up, and they wouldn't bleed, so they could get, you know, they could buy a little time that way. Until frostbite set in, and that's really important. As many as 85% of the Marines suffered from frostbite, and you know they lost fingers and toes and hands and feet and parts of their face. Many of these guys to this day, you know, to this day are suffering from neuropathies and all kinds of other long-term effects of frostbite. And they dream about it. You know, they say, I could never really get that chill out of my bones. You know, that that deep cold that just, you know, it's just all pervading and, you know, affects, you know, just down to your soul. You know, that's the way they talk about it. And, you know, I think many of us don't think of North Korea as being so cold, but it has this kind of unusual winter weather pattern where the winds come down from Siberia and Manchuria, and it just it just takes your breath away.
So what kind of reports was Smith sending back to MacArthur about how things were going?
Well, MacArthur finally, you know, after the first night or two of unbelievable fighting where the Marines were hanging on for dear life, it became abundantly clear, even to MacArthur, that this ain't going to work. We are not going to the Yalu. We are not going to be home by Christmas. We have to regroup, and we have to do something that no one in the armed forces likes to talk about, especially the Marines. We have to retreat. Now, the Marines never use the word retreat. And, you know, there are various euphemisms for a retreat, like an advance to the rear or a retrograde maneuver. General Smith famously said, we're not retreating. We're simply attacking in another direction. And what he meant by that really was that when you're completely surrounded by overwhelming numbers of the enemy who are trying to kill you, movement in any direction is an attack. And it was going to be every step of the way a fighting withdrawal. They knew that they were going to be fighting a battle while moving 70 miles through the mountains to the sea. And there is this kind of classical quality to this battle. You know, they marched up into those mountains, and then they have to march out. Everyone who studies military history knows that a well-organized, well-choreographed fighting withdrawal is the most difficult maneuver there is in warfare, because, you know, you have all these collapsing enclaves. You have all this sort of, you know, everything's on the move. You're having to destroy equipment to prevent the, in this case, the Chinese from getting at it as you're moving, and you're moving your wounded, and sometimes you're moving your dead, and you have all these vehicles, and you have close air support flying overhead, and you have artillery and flankers out on the mountains. It is a very complicated endeavor with many, many moving parts, and to make it work is just an incredible undertaking. And General Smith pulled this off with ferocity and ingenuity and by the book. And really, this is the reason the Marines celebrate this battle so much, even though you could technically call it a retreat, is that it was an exquisitely well choreographed fighting withdrawal. And, you know, they study it in the academies. They embrace it. You go to the Quantico National Marine Museum there, and you see it's one of the three battles that the Marines talk about: Battle of Belleau Wood in World War I, Battle of Iwo Jima in World War II, and this one. It's, even though, you know, it's technically a retreat, they certainly view it as a victory.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What was Smith thinking about on his way in with regard to how he would get out, whether he won or lost?
He never doubted that he would get out. He had great faith in his division, the 1st Marine Division. And, you know, really this book is very much a story of leadership. Everyone revered this general, and he made a series of just really smart decisions based on his earlier prescience that there was going to be a battle. And, you know, he had, in a weird way, he had four different enemies to contend with. He had the Chinese, he had the cold, he had the terrain, because this is impossible terrain to fight in. And then he had his, in a weird way, his own superiors, who he had to listen to. He didn't want to be fired for insubordination, but he had to kind of hear what they're saying and kind of delicately disobey them and stall and sometimes just incur their wrath. So it's a great study in leadership, how you kind of deal with these four different foes and keep your cool through the whole thing. And he was very adamant that they were going to come out as a intact division. They weren't going to be dispersed all over the place. He wanted to bring them all into one location, this place called Hagaru, which was his sort of his bastion. This is where the airfield was. This is where his headquarters was. He wanted to bring in all his regiments and then come out fighting together. And that's exactly what he did. And the 1st Marine Division reaches the sea, where there's an enormous evacuation that takes place on the level of Dunkirk. They're evacuated to South Korea, and they regroup, lick their wounds, and very soon are fighting again as a completely intact division.
What was the effect on the civilians who are living in and around that area?
Well, devastating, devastating. I mean, as is always true in war, it's the civilians who suffer the most, and they were buffeted by all these ebbings and flowings of the battle. The North Korean forces, the South Korean forces, the Chinese, the Americans, all this bombardment. And consequently, you had huge numbers of refugees coming out of the reservoir country and coming out of the cities down along the coast, Hamhung, Hungnam. You had over 100,000 who ended up getting on these ships as part of this enormous evacuation that I was speaking of. And it's a very important event in Korean history, this evacuation. More than a million contemporary South Koreans say that they descend from this evacuation. It's a very important thing. But they were removed from the battlefield and were repatriated in the South.
My guest is historian Hampton Sides. We're talking about his newest book, On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, The Korean War's Greatest Battle. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter @KERAThink. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with historian Hampton Sides, who is editor-at-large for Outside Magazine and author of the new book On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, The Korean War's Greatest Battle. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Maria in Mesquite. Hi, Maria.
Hi. You had mentioned that many of the survivors of this battle suffer from neuropathy and I'm sure other conditions. My stepfather is actually a Korean War veteran and neither a Marine nor at this battle, but suffered undiagnosed for many, many, many years, and the rest of us suffered along with him, from what was finally diagnosed only 15 years ago as PTSD. And from the descriptions you've given of this battle, it would seem to me that there'd be a whole lot of that being diagnosed in the survivors from this battle as well. But I also know that my stepfather was a man's man. He would not even consider being diagnosed for such a thing long after it became a fairly common diagnosis. I was wondering if you have any information on that and if you could share it, either specific to this battle survivors or Korea in general.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, these men are an extension of the quote-unquote greatest generation, the World War II generation. Many of them actually did fight in battles in the Pacific. Imagine that you fight Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. Well, of course, these guys have PTSD and all kinds of other long-term effects from this excruciating, harrowing fighting. But there was this kind of macho, manly man culture of not, just suck it up and, not acknowledging this. And I don't believe the term emerged until like the 1960s or 70s during the Vietnam War. But yes, many of the men I interviewed openly say. I mean, there's no shame in it anymore. Everyone acknowledges it. Of course, I have these horrible dreams. I have violent episodes. I'm paranoid at times. All of these other symptoms that come back to haunt them. So, of course, thankfully, the Veterans Administration has come to recognize it and, you know, applied more resources to it. It's a real thing, and at least some attention is being applied to it.
How did news of this battle reach the domestic front? How much attention were Americans paying to what was happening at Chosin?
Well, the first reports were depressing and desperate. They were called a lost legion. They said that, you know, it was the red trap, and that the 1st Marine Division was in danger of being annihilated. And, you know, pray for your brother, your son, your cousin, whoever you may have who's fighting with the 1st Marine Division. But then when this airfield was built, journalists started coming into the battle, and there's a particularly famous one, the first female war correspondent, Marguerite Higgins, who wrote for the New York Herald Tribune, and she was able to get some of the first reports out that, hey, on the contrary, these guys are coming out. They're coming in from the hills. They're reassembling in this bastion of Hagaru. There's an airstrip. And they're starting a very ambitious plan to march out of this trap and sort of bash their way out to the sea. So the news turned around very quickly. And, of course, it was celebrated as a great victory by Truman and by everyone back home, because the news elsewhere in Korea, particularly on the west side of the peninsula, was very depressing. It was an ignominious, you know, retreat. They were just in headlong retreat. This was a, you know, well-organized fighting withdrawal every step of the way, and something that Truman himself celebrated.
Do the Chinese and the North Koreans look back on this as an unmitigated victory for them? I mean, they lost, was it 30,000 men?
The Chinese?
Yeah.
Yes, as many as 30,000. You know, I guess Mao could say technically it was a victory for him because he ejected the Marines and the other men of the 10th Corps, which figures into the story, from the battlefield. But at what cost? As many as 30,000 Chinese died in those 17 days, whereas the Marine casualties are right around 1,000, which is just an unbelievable statistic. Mao, you know, treated his men like cannon fodder. They were not equipped to fight in this battle. Many of them didn't have gloves or socks. They were wearing these crepe-soled tennis shoes, and many of them didn't even have weapons. They were supposed to. The first wave was supposed to attack with weapons. They would get mowed down, and the second wave would come and pick up those weapons and keep going.
Wow.
So you know, it's really kind of sad, and certainly the Marines feel sorry for the Chinese. They view them as sort of brothers in suffering. They didn't want to be there. No one wanted to be out there. But Mao kept sending them wave after wave. And, you know, I don't think anyone else you can think of, certainly the United States forces or any of the UN forces, would have tolerated that level of casualty. But Mao seemed willing to. He, you know, his motives for being there are complicated. He had just won his civil war and wanted to flex his muscles on the world stage and sort of make his presence known. But I think he was also genuinely fearful of having American troops right on his border, on the Manchurian border. It would be like if Chinese forces had invaded Mexico and marched all the way to the Rio Grande.
You know, panic. We
certainly wouldn't have tolerated that. That's the way he looked at it. But it's you know, he's also wanting to help out his communist brethren to the south. You know, this is communism was a force that was spreading around the world, and he wanted to be a player in this. So the very complex series of motivations behind Mao's intervention in this war.
How much were the Chinese and the North Koreans thinking about the fact that the United States had just deployed nuclear weapons in Japan just a handful of years earlier?
Well, you know, it came up many times, and MacArthur very much wanted to use atomic weapons. He wanted to drop a bomb on Beijing, and he also at one point began to talk about sowing a permanent radioactive zone along the Yalu River to keep the Chinese out. I mean, this is the kind of crazy thinking that was going on. Mao said, bring it on. He famously talked about atomic weapons, and he basically said, we got more people than you've got weapons. And not only that, you have to remember that back then, China
was— That's
quite
a taunt.
Yeah, I know. But back then, China was— you know, very much a rural society, and there weren't huge concentrations of population like there are now. And it would be a very difficult city to, a country to attack in that way. They're from the hinterlands. They're a rice growing, you know, peasant economy, and it not only do you have to reckon with the moral question of should atomic weapons ever be used, but it just wouldn't have been effective in the end.
All right. We have an email here from Chris in Dallas who wants to know, could the U.S. have learned anything from the Chosen experience that might have helped us avoid the quagmire that was Vietnam?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you could say that our encounters with China demonstrate, you know, it's a perfect example of what we now call asymmetrical warfare. Two very different kinds of armies fighting each other. And we, you know, certainly MacArthur was very dismissive of the Chinese. He just said, you know, what they don't have an air force, they don't have tanks, they don't have anything but light artillery. We'll destroy them. But what, you know, we didn't reckon with was their flexibility of movement, the element of surprise, the way they could move over mountains and avoid the roads altogether, and the willingness that, you know, Mao's willingness to expend huge numbers against an enemy. And those are all things that were lessons, I think, that could have applied to the Vietnam War, for sure. Another one is, I think, you know, and this is something that we still need to think about is, you know, we weren't really listening to our field commanders. Smith could have, I think we could have avoided this whole battle if we'd listened more to General Smith and some of the other field commanders who know the situation on the ground. But it was a very much a top-heavy, top-down strategy. MacArthur in Tokyo, very much an absentee general. By the way, he never slept a single night on Korean soil. So he's not listening, and he doesn't want to know what the field commanders have to say. And I think that's certainly a takeaway that could have applied to Vietnam and still applies to this day.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How was Harry Truman finally convinced to sack Douglas MacArthur?
Well, that's a little after my book, but, you know, it was a series of things that MacArthur did. He was... You know, he just was defiant, and he would talk to the media and say things in direct opposition to what the official policy was. Also, all of this talk about dropping nuclear bombs just scared the bejesus out of Truman. I mean, Truman had already dropped two bombs on Japan, and I don't think he wanted to be the guy that was going to drop the third or the fourth or the fifth. And like I said earlier, he was just terrified that this was going to truly escalate into a world war. But, you know, by this point, it kind of was a world war. And I think, you know, because it's like a world war that was crammed down into one little piece of land. You know, it was the Chinese, the North Koreans, and the Russians who were getting more and more involved in this, maybe not with soldiers, but with their jets and with their advisors and everyone else. The Chinese, North Koreans, and then all the UN forces, all in this one peninsula. So it was, I guess, by this point, technically a world war.
What do you think accounts for the fact that, you know, at the end of all this, there was this strange ceasefire that continues to hold today? We hear talk, especially lately, that maybe both North and South Korea are interested in making this a more robust agreement. Is there another ceasefire like this in modern history?
I can't think of one. You know, technically the war never ended, and it's everyone's on high alert. And when you go to the DMZ, which I did with a group of veterans, UN veterans, you see that tension. You feel it in the air. It's scary, scary place. And of course, the North and South Koreans want to see an improvement in that relationship. As I said earlier, there's really no difference, or at least there used to not be any difference between North and South Korea. A lot of families were permanently divided, separated from each other, and they desperately want to see each other. And, you know, just culturally and in terms of trade and for every other reason you can think of, there's a deep desire to improve that relationship. I think it's one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why the Korean War is the kind of the forgotten war, is that we never really came to full closure that you would with a treaty. It was, just kind of languished in this, the narrative is unsatisfying because it's kind of messy. It didn't end cleanly. And, we're still suffering the consequences of that.
You mentioned much earlier in the hour that General Oliver P. Smith was a sort of thoughtful person. He was a fierce fighter, but he tended roses, that sort of thing. Was it his granddaughter that told you that his gardening boots were the boots he wore to fight that battle in Chosin?
Yeah, he after he retired, he went back to tending roses, and he had an orchard, and he gardened every day. And his gardening boots were his combat boots, the ones that he marched out of Chosin. And she found them, underneath his workbench. There they were, just the same boots that he'd worn, all those years ago.
Does that suggest something to you about the extent to which it stayed on his mind for decades later?
It never left him. And he was immensely proud of his Marines, the 1st Marine Division. He was the kind of person that was acutely aware of every casualty. I think he views this as a tragedy in the first place, because it should never have happened. Through bad leadership coming from the top, these men were put in an impossible situation. But then they broke out of that impossible situation with great heroism and ingenuity and just ferocity. And for that, it was enormously proud.
The new book by historian Hampton Sides is called On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, the Korean War's Greatest Battle. Hampton, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us.
Yeah, enjoyed it. That's great.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. We hope that you will pick a podcast app and then become a subscriber to the Think podcast. If you want to know what we have coming up on the show, check the website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.